Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
To this week's edition of the Group Chat podcast here at Virgin Media News. I am news correspondent Richard Chambers, joined as always by my dear colleagues, news correspondent Zara King.
Hello, how are you?
Good. And political correspondent Gavin Riley.
It's nice that we're dear colleagues.
A dear colleague.
A nice little elevating affirmation.
You. We missed you terribly.
I was away for a week and I've come with renewed gladness in my heart.
Absence makes the heart grow slightly deeper.
I was like, you know what? I mean, we did obviously do a bonus in between. It's not that I didn't miss doing the podcast, but it's nice to have a break from work every so often. Yes. You know what I mean? Especially this time of year, I actually find it's good to have something in the depths of midwinter.
Because it does get busy, even just, you know, socially coming up to Christmas. Seems to be sort of well rested for the end of your work rush and the Christmas party.
Is your calendar filling up? Is this?
I feel like it is, to be honest, actually. Not necessarily socially, just I do feel like the end of the year, there's lots of admin-y bits that you...
Like stuff you've put in the long finger.
Like our boss is chasing me to fill in your end of year, you know, your end of year paperwork and all that kind of stuff. So we're still sort of.
I'm not going to mention that war.
Pick your battles.
It is nice to have a break, though, at that time when the clocks have gone back and suddenly everything just feels a bit glummer. That for you, a bit of a getaway.
Yeah.
It's very nicely timed.
It was good.
And you've had a personal best in the running as well.
I did. Did the run in the dark last
Congratulations.
Night. So that went well. I was going to take it easy, as you do for
a fun
run.
You're back now, because you were saying you were going to physio for a while there.
I have physio again tomorrow, so maybe this will be all completely out of date and I'll be, you know, benched again.
If you're told to take it easy.
But yeah, so it was a good time off. So yeah, run in the dark, and I'm doing the Clontarf half marathon then this weekend, which will be fun. Hopefully another, well, it's the first that I ever run at that point.
I was going to say, like, have you ever done a half marathon before?
No.
Okay.
So new ground to be struck.
And this is exciting, as you said about your birthday, by the way. Happy birthday.
Absolutely. Happy birthday. Bo's also lost the FAI Cup final.
I wasn't going to bring it up, actually.
I literally was like, let's not bring that up with him.
Which is a nice weekend. Let's not go there.
It was your birthday week. We weren't going to do it to you, so I'm sorry.
Thanks, Bo's. Always reliable.
But Waterford United's been promoted, which is obviously very exciting.
The Blues are back.
So they're back, So maybe perhaps we'll see a Waterford United Bows game next season.
Absolutely.
And I will go to that with you.
There you go.
UCD got relegated, but Man United are the most informed team in the Premier League. So easy come, easy go.
I mean, it's the roundabout of sport is what it is. But roundabouts as well in RTE, because now they have the plan. The plan has been unveiled and they've also been given all the money. Not all the money, but they've basically been indicated.
They've been told they're going to get the money, but some of the money is being held back until they do the things that they said they were going to do in order to qualify for the money.
Explain the things, Gav.
So the things are largely what are included in this new strategic vision for RTE, which was briefed by Kevin Backhurst to RTE staff on Tuesday. Quite unfortunately, managed to make its way into some elements of the media on Monday, which meant that a lot of RTE staff found out about the prospect of significant job cuts in their organisation by getting push alerts from other outlets, not hearing it from
which is always a terrible way to handle things. I'm just going to be straight.
Every journalist is, of course, going to report something significant when it comes to the strategic future of RTE, but it is crummy that staff would find out in such a way. But nonetheless, that is
when
one of the elements.
When you're a journalist yourself, though, it's particularly crummy, I have to say. I think it's a bit...
You have an understanding of it, but you also know that it's just a bit crap.
Yeah, it is.
But is there any indication where the leak would have emanated from? Is this something that was presented, the plan was presented to government, and then it leaked out of government? Or was this just because there were so many people who had knowledge of this plan as it was being made up and submitted?
The plan was submitted to senior ministers in government, so basically the line minister Catherine Martin and by extension then the coalition leaders last Friday, which meant that they and their inner circles and teams of advisors would have been strewing over its contents over the weekend, and it made its way out through political correspondence. I think the first person to do reporting on it was Pat Lee, even the Irish Times, so you can imagine that it probably made its way out through the armoury of people, officials and politicians that are around government buildings rather than from RTE directly. And to be fair, RTE, even when they were approached for comment about it on Monday after those initial reports, were understandably very reticent to comment on anything because their view was the staff needs to know first. Anyway, as regards the substance of the deal, the plan proposes eliminating or reducing RTE's headcount by way of full-time staff by 20% over the next 5 years. That translates to somewhere between 350 and 400 jobs, which are going to be cut. There's going to be the closure of some services, like four of the digital radio stations. The RT 1+1 and 2+1services are all going to be cut. There's going to be a downsizing of the campus in Montrose, which will result in some areas being moved to Cork and over time also to Galway and Limerick. And also, whether this amounts to a slimming down of internal stuff isn't clear, but that they're going to be involved in more commissioning of external independent programming, which a lot of people think will mean that people who currently work for RTE making those programs in-house will probably be let go because that programming will now be done by outside bodies instead.
Yeah, and it was described by the unions and staff then in RT because of that, you know, farming out as they see it of key RT functions, which is to create Irish programming to independent private companies, that this is some in some ways a privatisation or a hollowing out of RT and its responsibilities. I mean, is that a, is that sad to see, Zara, that we are seeing, you know, this is going to be a very different RT by the time all this is done than the one that we've all grown used to?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, look, you know, the reality is like people will see certain staff members in RT who are on TV and in front of the cameras and that's their understanding of the organisation. But actually, there's so much more that happens behind the scenes. And actually, I had a chance to meet a lot of those staff when I was over covering the demonstrations during the summer. People who work in the background who are crucial and instrumental to, you know, getting the crews dispatched, for example, and the programs on air and the resources and things. So yeah, it is a big change. I mean, look, I think the reality is that something had to change. It had to be a watershed moment what unfolded in RTE. But it is unfortunate to see that at the bottom line here will be staff members who had nothing to do with the misappropriation of you know, spending money or not spending money, that had nothing to do with any of the top end of the scandal, and they're the ones who will find themselves losing their jobs. And that's actually the real problem here.
Which is actually just worth reflecting on that note, because a lot of attention has been paid to the fact that there will now be a de facto pay cap for anyone, including contractors like external presenters working in RTE, how none of them will be allowed to earn more than the director general, which at present is 250 grand a year. And people have singled out, well, that affects a sum total of three people. Now, obviously, if you are Joe Duffy or Claire Byrne or Miriam O'Callaghan and you're being asked to take a pay cut the next time there's a contract, it's a bit of a blow for you. But that's three people out of like 1,800. And a fifth of those people are going to lose their jobs outright. In the grand scheme of things, like, I wouldn't want to be taking a pay cut from 300,000 down to 250, but it's a good problem to have. But that is a very small saving that will be made from three people's salaries. Whereas by comparison, there's going to be a fifth of people who are losing their jobs entirely. And not all of them will be able to find their feet in the independent sector making the same programming on an external basis. A lot of those people will probably have to change careers.
So in terms of the 400 people who are going to be leaving the company over between now and 2028, a lot of those people are going to be people who are just going to retire and their jobs aren't going to be replaced. There will be a voluntary scheme. Of course, Kevin Backhurst last month said that RTE couldn't afford such a scheme even if it wanted to have one, but he says
it's changed on that front.
Basically, he said that the money for this, the immediate scheme, voluntary redundancy scheme, which will basically come into effect next year, it's going to come from the sale of Montrose land, which has already taken place. So from the pre-sale Montrose land, they basically have a bit of cash reserve from that, which they're putting aside to that. That's where they're channeling that to fund that. As well as that,
couldn't they have afforded it before now then, if they just chosen to tap into that money?
I don't know. Well, you have to go through the books, I suppose. But anyway, another thing as well is that the people are going to be looking or offering these voluntary redundancies for, the main area they're going to be targeting is people who are earning over 100,000 euro. So that is something which is worth bearing in mind as well, is that they are aware of the potential backlash, as you say, Zara, to people who are the lower earning people, the more regular workers in RTE, effectively bearing the brunt. So they're trying to make sure that in terms of how this is all presented, where some of the sort of the bigger issues are, that they are looking at sort of the more higher earners. There are a lot of people in RTE who do earn over 100,000 euro per annum, whether that be presenters, correspondents or managers. And they're the people going to be looking
at. About 110 of them, I think, or 120. Do you remember the PAC was given a list, anonymised list of the top 100 earners? And I think the 100th highest earner was on about 110,000. So you can probably surmise that there's maybe about 120 or 30 people who are on six-figure salaries. So you could target them, but a lot of them are also...
But if you're looking for 400 people, then it still means that like roughly 300 people just under that are going to be, you know, in that situation. Look, it's like it's a very difficult situation for the staff and RTE. But Richard, you know, when we talk about things like particularly, say, reinvestment in like Cork and, you know, regional offices, that's not a bad thing. That's no bad thing. You know, I mean,
it's
long overdue in Cork.
I think there's a lot in the outline of this plan. There will be a more up-to-date, more fuller plan presented basically by the start of next year. There are some things which are quite positive and are long overdue, as you say, a more regional balance. There is too much of a Dublin focus in terms of the volume and the quantity of things which are made by RTE, the national broadcaster, purely around Dublin. As well as that, the refocusing on digital, which is what something they've been, I mean, RTE have been banging the drum about investing in digital for a long, long time.
A new player now.
Exactly, yeah. A new player, which is something which everybody and their mother has been complaining about for donkey's years now, incessantly.
Say to their credit, though, the website is very good. I think the news website is very good to its credit. Mm. And I think their news app is very good, actually.
There's a new news app.
Yeah, I think to their credit, those things are very good.
So, yeah, and I think this is part of the overall plan. And it is because this is the thing. You aren't just trying to sell this plan to the staff and not just trying to sell it to the government. You're also trying to sell it to the public. So what's in it for the public? Because you need the public to start paying their TV licenses again. Mm. So you, whatever is in this plan.
How do you get people to do that, though?
This is what you have to do. You have to make sure that they feel that they're getting value for money, that there's not too much fat on the bone here for RTE, that it's not this largesse and excess that people have seen in Dáil committees over the last number of months and that summer of drama, that they want to see value for money. They want to see a better digital product. The front face of RTE needs to be a lot more accessible and a lot more value for money than it has been. And I think digital is probably where people are going to interact with RTE a lot more than even just having the TV or the radio on in the background.
Something of a double-edged sword, though, isn't it? Because if you have to start cutting back on services of people that feel like they're getting value for money, those who were already paying, the very slim majority who are still paying the €160 every time it falls due, they're now going to feel like they're getting less value for the money each time because they were previously paying for, you know, the four national radio stations and the six digital ones and the Plus Ones and the RTE News channel and all these other ancillary services that they now might not be getting. And there's also, separately, you know, when you talk about the outsourcing of some functions or having them made by the independent sector, like news and current affairs is so core to RTE stuff that it can't be done there. But other things like Fair City, like would Fair City now have to be made by an independent company and basically bought in by RTE? Or even sports things, like, you know, we look at the deluxe, you know, totally appropriate, like high-end production values that go into doing an All-Ireland final for hurling or football and all the extra cameras that you've got on Jones's Road to get all the colour and the ones that are there to get them off the buses. Like the real deluxe stuff that, you know, we, hand on heart, would not be able to replicate because we just don't have the means to do that. If you outsource all of that to a private company, that you're not going to get it done to the same quality because no independent producer has the means or resources to do it in the same way as RTE does. So the viewer loses out because the product that you get just isn't as well put together.
Well, the point on that is, I think Backhurst yesterday, we were chatting to Kevin Backhurst in the 5:30. He didn't want to single out any specific programme in terms of, well, that might be farmed out to the independent production sector. Mm. But there is going to be an emphasis in this in live programming. So in terms of live programming, well, sport is one of the probably the key for that. In terms of ratings winners, if it's live programming, it's your news, which isn't going to be affected by this, and it's going to be sport. So I think that's probably going to be something they're going to protect, and it is something which they've invested a lot of their money, the cash they have on hand. Sporting rights has been a big thing that they've opened the wallet for before, so I'd say that's probably something that they want to protect. But everything else, there was no refusal to sort of, you know, dampen down any speculation that the likes of a Fair City or the likes of even any sort of entertainment programs or any other programming might be amongst the things which are looked at in the future. So, I mean, these are huge changes. Do you think that it will be enough, Sarah, based on what you've heard so far, for the public to get back on board?
I know that's an interesting question. I just think this question around the license fee is so interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, like, I've interviewed so many people on the streets about this in the last couple of months, and they'll say to you, like, look, it was one less thing to pay for. Like, it's just people are really honest about that. You know what I mean? They kind of feel like they're justified and they're not paying for it at the moment. And I just don't know how do you, like, circle that back. How do you get back to a place where people, you know, like, how many, you know, do you run loads of ads on TV, you know, people knocking on your front door, the TV license inspector, do you try and, you know, frighten people into paying it again? I don't know what's the motive here? Like, how, I don't know how you get it back around again. Like, I don't think that, while I have to say my heart does go out, I have to say to anyone who's going to find themselves, you know, losing their jobs and all of this, because, like I say, I really do worry that it will be people who've worked incredibly hard, who are not necessarily the big stars of RTE, that have been the backbone of the organisation, that will end up, you know, losing their jobs. While my heart goes out to the individuals, I do actually feel quite hopeful about the changes, and I'm hopeful that, you know, it will be a more resilient and a more sustainable state broadcaster. So look, there's definitely hope in it. What was the mood, did you think, Richard, of Kevin Backhurst and all of this? You know, what was his sense of it? Did he feel, like, positive about these changes that were going to be implemented, or?
Yeah, like, I mean,
hard to read.
Standard brave face, well able. Like, I mean, he's been doing the rounds as he has done for any sort of milestone along his path of since he's come in as Director General. He's done basically run the gamut of all media interviews available. And he doesn't seem to be, he doesn't seem to be shrinking in the light of any of the questions that have been arisen so far on it. He was sort of saying that he believes that, yeah, there is some good questions which are being asked by staff, but he doesn't feel that staff are up in arms that this is going to be some sort of an industrial relations situation at this point in time. Although I'd counteract that in saying that, you know, unions out at RT, including SIPTU, for example, have described this as something that they are going to fight, but we don't know what that might mean at this point in time. Some staff were just like, look, this is a sad day in many ways, that it is, you know, a cutting out of some of the key features of RTE. And, you know, they felt that over the years, while there was excess in RTE and there were things which they weren't happy about in terms of the direction that RTE had taken in recent years, they felt that at least they were investing in the future and that they had, you know, this is an institution in Ireland which has been around for decades and decades and decades from the very earliest days of the state. And now you're coming to a point in time where, you know, some of those facilities, some of those key roles, they feel are going to be surrendered to companies which are outside of that.
I don't think that this will necessarily be enough to straighten everything out. And I think there might be a request for more money again sometime later next year. If you just run the sums, so the license fee, RT's total income is about 350 million euro a year, or at least was before all of this. The license fee was just over half of that. So you could say the license fee was give or take 180, 90 million. And if a third of people don't pay the license fee, which is totally, you know, foreseeable, then you lose 60 or 70 million out of the money that you were due to get from TV license fee. And if the government is only plugging up 40 million of that, there will be another deficit and they're going to have to possibly go back to the well. And that might mean more uncomfortable decisions for RTE and government in the later half of next year.
Yeah, and probably more uncomfortable truths will probably come out as well, because most of those reviews, which are still yet to be completed, more of those and potentially more bad news and more things from RTE's past getting in the way of its future. Now, after many weeks of waiting, on Tuesday night there was the news that a large number of Irish citizens who have been waiting to get out of Gaza will now be leaving. We're recording this on Wednesday afternoon. The process of moving people who are Irish citizens out of Gaza has begun. If anything develops while we're recording this, if we get any word, we'll bring it to you. But while this is good news, Zara, it is a bittersweet moment for a lot of these people as well.
Oh, God, yeah, it absolutely is. Because I suppose we have to remember that just because these people are among, I suppose we should consider the lucky ones, I mean, they haven't been lucky at all. They've been through an incredibly difficult couple of weeks. They are now saying goodbye to people who they love, who are not on any list, who are not dual citizens of any other country, who have no chance of leaving, no chance of getting out. And that is hard. They don't know if they say goodbye to these loved ones, will they ever see them again? So it's a real, like, it's bittersweet in the most severe way, because the relief of being able to flee the war zone, or, you know, get out of that danger zone, but knowing that you may not see those loved ones again. You know, I know of an example of one lady who is on the list to get out today, but, you know, had hoped to help get somebody else's children out, but the children aren't on the list, and, you know, she has her own children, and so she has to go and you know, not aid those kids to get out. Hopefully they will get out in the coming days, but, you know, even that alone, having to make that decision to sort of say I've got to go, you know, it's really, really difficult.
Without personalising it too much, like, Richard, you have an ongoing contact with Ibrahim Halaga and his family over the last sort of month or so. Like, it must be very raw for them, that kind of sense of this being a double-edged bittersweet moment, that they're able to end this for themselves, but they know there's plenty of others for whom this is going on.
Yeah, completely. And so Ibrahim basically found out last night that his name was going to be on the list. He confirmed that to us in Virgin Media News. We're the first people outside the family who he told. And it was basically, he's had many sleepless nights since he's been in Gaza with his family, with his three young kids, his wife Amida, who we've heard from, and they've documented their experience in Gaza since the war began. But this is the first sleepless night where there was potentially a positive outcome, because this is what they'd been looking for, was to get out. But if you think about everything that they've already gone through from the start of this, like, when they came to Gaza on an extended holiday to see their family, they had an apartment in Gaza City, which Ibrahim had invested effectively his life savings in. They were very proud about all the work they'd done to redo that, which had been that apartment, which had been badly damaged in the last round of violence before all of this. That's now been destroyed in Israeli airstrikes. All three of those children have suffered the impacts of starvation, drinking unclean water. They have woken up in the middle of the night screaming at the sound of airstrikes. They have heard the incessant buzzing of Israeli drones over the family farmhouse nonstop over the last number of, of weeks. As well as that, they have also lost literally dozens of members of their extended family. And for all of that, now they're on the way out. And it was basically a last minute. As far as the Alaga family is concerned, they thought this was a last minute thing because they actually issued an appeal directly to the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach yesterday because there was a blackout coming as of the time of recording that there's no fuel to run phones and data services in Gaza. So if the data services are gone, how are you going to know you're on the list? How are you going to be in contact with the Irish Embassy and the Department of Foreign Affairs? They felt that today, Wednesday, was their last chance of getting out. Now, luckily, that has worked out. But they leave behind them their family members, Ibrahim's parents, aunts, uncles, loved ones, friends who have all helped each other through this process and who will now have to stay in the Gaza Strip under siege, which is being obviously now in Israeli invaded now at this point in time. And just starvation. There's no fuel. So again, as of today, there was it was initially reported at the start of the day that fuel was getting through the Rafah crossing. So the Rafah crossing today, with all 30 Irish people hopefully going through it, touch wood, plus everybody else who's going through that, there's also fuel going through for the first time. However, what was not initially disclosed is that the fuel is not going to be used to run water services or the hospitals, which you might talk about a little bit later on. It's to fuel the aid trucks so that they can continue to go back and forth. So
wow. The aid trucks, which are already not carrying enough aid as it currently stands anyway.
So this is the situation which the people, the Irish Palestinian people who are now leaving today and who may be leaving more, leaving tomorrow potentially, they are leaving all this behind them. That is a very difficult thing. Notwithstanding all of the trauma and all the things that they have seen over the last number of weeks, they leave family members and loved ones behind who they know will have to live with this for the very foreseeable future.
And moreover, that it's such a long possible road to any kind of normality coming back, because these are things which effectively happen to these communities overnight. But it's not as if, you know, you ostensibly could have a ceasefire in a week or two or three and then things go back to normal afterwards, because the scale of the infrastructural damage is such that it's not as if you could just restore heat or restore fuel or restore energy or restore water and things go back to normal, because people are going to be living in refugee camps or in refuges or in other places because their homes are destroyed. And you can't just turn that back. And I just can't imagine how difficult that must be for people who are lucky enough to be able to get out, but who know that those they're leaving behind are just destined to be dealing with this damage, this like barely qualifies as life.
Yeah.
For who knows how long. I can't imagine what that's like.
No, and I also think as well, we need to remember, and that's a really good point that you make, Gavin, about the fact that even if there was a ceasefire in the morning, the cleanup operation and the idea of trying to rebuild your life is just so vast.
It's years of a job.
It's really difficult to know. But then you look at people who will talk about, because I know one of the clips that you had sent on when you were away, actually, of Ibrahim's little boy was talking about how they'd just gotten the apartment in Gaza City cleaned up after the last escalation and that they were just delighted to have gotten the place tidied up, and like, you know, he talked about his little World Cup trophy, his kids' World Cup trophy, all his little bits and pieces, and that they had such pride in their home, but that was part, they had to clean that up after, you know. And I think like that's, you know, when you speak to people, you know, I spoke to a young guy, Mohanad, who, you know, grew up in Gaza and now lives in Ireland, and his mum and his little baby sister actually are on the list, fingers crossed, to get out today. But like, he says to me at that time, like, you know, Zara, I lived through like three escalations, but by the time I was 15, he'd lived through three different escalations. So like, even if there's a ceasefire tomorrow and they try and rebuild their lives, you're permanently living in fear of when the next outbreak is coming, you know?
The thing about it as well is that northern Gaza, I don't know how hospitable, you know, or habitable it's going to be for a long, long time to come. And you hear comments being made by Israeli ministers saying that, well, maybe it'll be a good thing if the voluntary movement, as he described it, of Gazans out of Gaza, and that they permanently do not come back, if that might be a solution to the situation in Gaza. Which
the solution is just evacuating,
just move,
just uninhabited forever.
Now, like, I don't know if that was a solo run, if that was the Israeli position on this.
That would be a war crime.
That is textbook definition of that, is the mass displacement in that sense. But that is something which is obviously a consideration as well, particularly now when you see what's happening around the main hospitals in Gaza. Al-Shifa Hospital, which is the biggest hospital in Gaza, again, it has been, I think since the incursion began, it has been, you know, probably one of the major stories that Israel has, you know, identified a number of hospitals and said, this is where Hamas is hiding. Its command centers and whatnot. And this is where internationally things start to fall apart in terms of where do people push back on what's happening in Gaza? Where do you appeal for constraint? Where do you say, oh, well, Israel has the right to defend itself? Because that's where it's all starting to get hazy and the international response just falls to bits. The World Health Organization has lost contact with its doctors who are in there. You have some doctors who are able to get the word out. They're describing scenes of absolute chaos and panic as people are being pulled away from their families and they've heard shots fired and whatnot. This is a very, very, very dark situation.
Very grim. And you know what, actually, as you say that, just it reminds me of a clip I was mentioning to you in the newsroom a couple of weeks ago. Like 2 weeks ago, I was quoting a clip of Dr. Mike Ryan from the WHO. People remember him. He's the Irish... What's Mike Ryan's title exactly? He's clinical director or something. I should know that. But him talking about... Well, no longer, but...
Executive director.
Executive director, yeah.
Health emergency program.
Pretty significant. And an Irish man. But Dr. Mike Ryan 2 weeks ago, before all of this happened, Richard, but, you know, saying that... How can they open field hospitals in Gaza? How can they send in more medical practitioners when they can't even guarantee the safety of the people that are there at the moment? And he said he's worked in many, you know, crisis zones in his entire career. And he said he's never seen anything like this. It is beyond any sort of, like, I worry sometimes, and I talked to you about this last week, Gavin, I said, I really do worry sometimes that we are becoming slightly desensitized, or that people are, you know, every time people open up their social media, that they're kind of, you know, they're seeing all these images, and like, you know, it's been nearly five weeks now. Like, I think it's really important for everyone to continue to like remind yourself that this is a lived experience of people. Like, this is not just another day of shocking images, because, you know, and that's human nature. Like, how many times are you going to be exposed to pictures of you know, buildings collapsed and people being pulled from the rubble before you kind of go, oh, it's just, you know, it's not like every day things are getting worse.
Yeah. And I think that's why, I mean, sometimes you can look at it and just to put on like your sort of wonky journalist sort of hat on, you're like, well, why are we looking for, you know, Irish voices in this story?
Yeah.
But it has been a way that a lot of people have actually connected with the stories, whether it be Thomas Hand speaking about his daughter, Emily, who's suspected of being taken hostage by Hamas, or it is Ibrahim documenting life under siege and bombardment. And it is the little details of like the lived experiences of people who are able to share it in a position where it's very, very difficult. But that is, if that's what the anchor is to people, to help them to understand what life for ordinary people is in these situations, well, then that is nothing but a good thing. Like, I mean, since I was speaking to Ibrahim last night, kind of refreshing the phone, he's gone out of phone coverage at this point in time, somewhere between, in that sort of no man's land between Gaza and Egypt in the processing sort of thing. Like, the amount of people who are continually messaging saying, looking for updates now. And I think that is a good sign that people are connecting. And it is. Sometimes it can be the micro, the one individual family, or, you know, one person story, or two people's, or connecting with it because it's Irish, whatever. Maybe that is, if that's what helps people to understand it and get to grips with it, the human cost of all of this. Well, then maybe that's, you know, that is an important thing that people
are
doing.
Can I ask you as well, because I know, and maybe you don't want to probably, but I just think, you know, it's interesting. You've been so close to the family and you've been talking to them all the time. Were you worried about them for a while on a personal level?
I think and it is, because there was the point when, just when the invasion began after all of the bombardment, and we remember we were waiting for weeks and weeks and weeks for Israel to go in on the ground attack. And then the phones went off. I was pretty certain, and even from chatting to Ibrahim, he won't mind me saying this, that we were pretty sure that we may never, this was probably the last time we were going to be chatting. Like, you had to do things to sort of, like, he asked me at one point, again, he won't mind me sharing this, he's like, just here's my low coordinates on a map, so that if it's a question of recovery, this is how people can find me. It's like Khan Yunis. That's why it's been such a huge concern over the last number of days when phone coverage has dropped out because of fuel problems, that you don't know if the phone's ever going to, if you're ever going to get the two ticks on WhatsApp again. That has been a huge concern. Like, it has been one of the things which people have done and volunteered to do, and there has been a lot of reporting on it, is this connecting Gaza thing where people in Gaza have been connected by this journalist who's based in Egypt. It's worth looking up on Instagram. So the people who can keep connecting with people who are in Gaza by using Israeli eSIMs.
Okay.
So that, because basically that you're hooking yourself up virtually to an Israeli phone network so that it won't really matter if the phone systems are down
so
in Gaza.
Palestinian ones run out of fuel, that they can keep the Israeli masts going and that you'll be able to work off their servers instead of the other ones.
Exactly, yeah. And that has been something which has worked particularly for people who are closer to the border wall, effectively. Hasn't worked all the time. Ibrahim, it has not really worked for at all, which is why, again, today was the deadline, really, in terms of getting him out.
Isn't it so remarkable that, you know, it's come today, given the fact that deadline, you know, sort of was looming over it.
Yeah.
On the day when Micheál Martin is also there.
Can I ask about this, Gavin? Because, like, this is something which is, this is very last minute out of the blue.
Yeah.
This trip. Micheál Martin, we obviously spoke about the fact that he went to the Middle East before this all happened.
So I was there in the West Bank using Israeli eSIMs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now he's going back to the same places again. And this was all very last minute. Is there a feeling that there are, you know, that there was an element of making things happen here?
You pointed out to us over the weekend that Poland had been one of the other big EU member states that hadn't really had any citizens evacuated until such time as their security minister travelled to the region at the weekend, and suddenly there was movement and the citizens started going. One thing which I don't know whether either of you guys have been told by the diplomats whenever you do the UN week in New York, but certainly I've been told it whenever we do Washington for St. Patrick's Day. Diplomacy is a contact sport. And this, by the way, underpins the reason why the government is rejecting those motions in the Dáil today and it wants to keep the Israeli ambassador here. Diplomacy is a thing that you achieve by going to see people face to face. And if you are a peripheral island on the far side of Europe and you're ringing up the local embassy being like, come on, can you help get our guys out? Like the Egyptian embassy and all the consulates there and everyone in Tel Aviv and everyone in Jerusalem and those on the ground in Gaza and Ramallah have so many other different competing demands that if you are just sitting on a phone at the other corner of a continent making phone calls and hoping things are going, they're leaving you on hold. It's two blue ticks and you're not getting a reply. Mm-hmm. You have to go out there and shake hands and do stuff. Now, I don't want to run positive PR and say that there's a definite link between Micheál Martin showing up in Cairo and there suddenly being movement for Irish citizens on the same day. But it's difficult not to think that there's a probable link. Mm. And that is a positivity. And Micheál Martin will now go to Israel. He'll speak to Eli Cohen, the Minister for Foreign Affairs, second time in 2 months. He'll go to Ramallah and speak to Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, for the second time in 2 months. If you want to get things done, by its nature, you have to go out and see people and see the whites of their eyes. That's why embassies exist. It's why the UN exists. Otherwise, you just have video calls. But you go out there and you have people deployed there to go and talk to each other in the flesh.
It does kind of go back to that old-fashioned press the flesh, you know, have that conversation thing. And it's probably one of the reasons why Tom Hand ended up coming to Dublin this week as well. Mm. So we had obviously spoken to Tom Hand last week on Zoom and didn't actually expect that he would be 7 days later in front of us in Dublin and got a call to say that he was here. Tom Hand very much feels that, you know, making these journeys, and he's going to the United States later this week, and I think he's going to be coming back from the States to the UK, just having face-to-face conversations, asking people to help, basically, you know, making representations to them. Sitting down with Tom on Monday, like, do you know what? It's just, so our producer said to me in the newsroom during the week, like, how was the interview? How was Tom Hand? I said, Tom Hand is actually, my heart, you just couldn't even begin to put yourself into his shoes and what he's going through. I mean, I know, and people have, what we've watched the interviews, but actually when you meet him in person, he actually held up his hand. He's shaking constantly. He is constantly shaking. He says he feels that shaking inside and on the outside. He is living in this constant fear and just wants his daughter home, just wants to know that she's safe, wants any sign, any indication that she's all right. And, you know, it's remarkable that he has held himself together as long as he has, because, you know, I just don't know. But the idea of travelling, as you say, Richard, and having that face-to-face conversation, he's really hoping that those journeys will have an impact. I mean, he's hoping that Micheál Martin will have an impact this week for Emily's case.
Micheál Martin today thanking the Egyptian foreign minister for his proactive engagement in terms or in relation to the hopeful release then of Emily Hand. He says that everyone is seized with this, a child captive, kidnapped and held in a war zone. So this is something actually I think that there is actually in terms of broad political support for the efforts that were made here. There was initially a lot of, should we be doing this? Should we be going out there and speaking to the Israelis?
Because there are some who would think that if Israel is guilty of such horrible crimes as you might see them to be, that you shouldn't be going out there and having any kind of diplomatic engagements at all. You should be trying to turn them into a pariah state. It's a legitimate view, but the alternative view is if you don't go out there and talk to them face to face, nothing gets done.
Yeah. So I think that it's very rare that we're in a situation where we're seeing diplomacy happen in real time with potential benefits of it happening like this. I suppose all we can say at this point in time is that we're going to keep our eyes peeled across, you know, all of the situations relating to Gaza and Israel over the next number of days. And if there's anything to update people on, we'll bring it to you.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There have been a shedload of bad UK political dramas made over the last number of years for various TV production companies. I didn't see a twist in any of those bad productions.
That's so good.
As unpredictable and as weird as David Cameron emerging from the, I think it was a Land Rover or a Range Rover, yeah, and walking up 10 Downing, or walking up Downing Street towards number 10. He's back. It was
one of Burley's reaction.
It was one of the more fun moments in our group chat on Monday morning when that happened, and I shared with you. Like, yeah. Sky tweeted the video of Kay Burley and Sam Coates, their deputy political editor, standing there like watching the people coming down number 10 and going, right, okay, here's somebody, or coming in Downing Street, watching someone climb out of a Jeep, going, who's it going to be? This person is obviously in the frame for a senior government job in this reshuffle. And then, like, the stunned silence before the David Cameron?
The actual punctuation of that, the actual shock in the voice.
It was so good.
Genuinely a momentous occasion in broadcasting.
Honestly, I've just been, like, hooked to my veins all week. I've just been glued to... I've had Sky News on all week and in the background as I'm pottering around. I just find these twists and turns truly phenomenal.
Not since Bobby Ewing.
It's pure Bobby Ewing territory.
All the comparisons there. There's the Bobby Ewing Dallas thing. There's the, you know, people were comparing to George Costanza in Seinfeld just coming back and pretending like, you know, that he'd never been fired or whatever.
Pretended he hadn't been fired and just showed up and tried to brazen it out.
But it's just like, you know, a relegated football team in England just getting Sam Allardyce on the phone. Like, we'll get the other guy back again.
Oh, my gosh.
But good reference.
What's the goal here of bringing David Cameron?
Well, I would say number one, it was to get people to stop talking about Suella Braverman, which, like, they're still talking about her, but, like, not as much, though. You know what I mean?
It's that whole thing of, like, putting a dead cat on the table and it being a total, it just moves the conversation away.
I mean, it definitely has. It has nudged it on a small bit. Obviously, she came out yesterday and had her few bits to say, but, like, you know, ultimately it has moved it on a bit.
Everything that Rishi Sunak is doing in the last 2 months or so has been geared at, like, what can we do to arrest this idea that we are a busted flush and that we might have a prospect of scraping out another majority at the next election? Yeah. Which is within the next 12 months. So, like, this is a real thing. David Cameron put out a statement on Monday after his reappointment, which said something interesting, that he was now going to be part of a government that was basically going to put the proposition to the people. In other words, this is Rishi Sunak's election team. David Cameron is going to be Britain's voice, their foreign secretary.
Unelected David Cameron.
Yeah, well,
Lord Cameron.
Considering that David Cameron had to resign last time because he lost a campaign and people decided that they didn't want unelected people determining Britain's foreign policy. And now you've got Lord Cameron in the House of Lords, accountable to nobody, deciding these things. But so basically, it is an attempt to portray we are serious people.
Yeah, and this is a grown-up returning.
We are responsible grown-ups and we are capable of running the country.
Is that Rishi sort of almost conceding that, you know, he was running a crash cabinet?
Kind of can be.
Crash cabinet. But, like, that's going to be the title of the episode now.
But what's to say about his party that, you know, there was nobody there who was a qualified candidate for the Foreign Office and that he to the back catalogue and was like, get me that guy.
Just play Wonderwall, Rishi.
But, like, because I can see this in two ways. In some ways, I can actually see this as, after many years of unserious people, as, you know, other governments would see them in the Foreign Office and in British government leadership, that they have a guy now who has a bit of gravitas in an international level. And on the other hand, I see this as the guy who literally kicked off all of the chaos.
I was just about to say that. Like,
over the last couple of years, who called the Brexit referendum.
Not just that chaos, but also objectively, when he was the Prime Minister, like, foreign affairs and foreign policy was the one bit that he continually kept screwing up, because not alone was there the, obviously, calling the referendum, which, you know, was supposed to be an attempt to lance the boil and ended up just, you know, spewing over everything for the 7 years since then. But also, he was responsible for helping to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi, which, you know,
that was
objectively
it
worked out to be a disaster because there was another civil war, which is still ongoing ever since. Mm-hmm. He also tried to, I think, became the first prime minister in, like, nearly 100 years to lose a vote in the Commons about foreign policy, because do you remember there was the use of chemical weapons in Syria by the Assad regime backed by Russia? And he wanted to intervene militarily to say, like, no, this is a line we can't allow to cross. And he couldn't convince his own parliament, full of his own backbenchers, that intervening was a good idea. Now, people would say, yeah, well, it's, maybe it shouldn't be your place to get involved. But Britain's failure to get involved is arguably what has emboldened Vladimir Putin to do everything he's done ever since. But so that's on David Cameron for doing that.
Yeah, there's a lot, a couple of things there. All right. Yeah. There's a few bits there. But Richard, do you think, as you mentioned there, you know, do you think that there's an element of like subtly reminding people of better times pre-Brexit, and that David Cameron is a sort of a hark back to maybe a more stable time in Britain when Britain wasn't, you know, a sort of, I want.
He was very, popular. He was very popular. He won some big elections
as well. He was a young, vibrant, yeah. Young girl.
But for so many people, he's going to be the guy who brought in Brexit, and then, as yeah, Danny Dyer said, stuck his trotters up in Nice, and then did some was involved in lobbying scandals since leaving the office.
Oh yeah, of course.
Very disappointed. If you're going to channel Danny Dyer, you're not going to do the accent.
No, I can't do it. Can't do it.
Also, folks, do Google Piggate.
Just to go back to it in case anybody forgets it. Yeah. One thing, actually, on a serious note, David Cameron's position previously on Gaza is actually something which would probably see him to the left and more Gaza sympathetic than even the Labour Party in Britain are at the moment, in which he's described Gaza as an open air prison and basically said there's no way that you're ever going to solve this if you continue to treat people, yeah. i.e. people in Gaza, yeah. as if they are prisoners in an open air thing and cut off from vital services. That's something to watch out for, because he is also considered a friend of Israel.
There is
one masterstroke, actually, in the whole situation, in all of this whole charade that was played out writ large on Sky News, is that there was actually a bit of a masterstroke pulled by Rishi Sunak here, in that he booted Suella Braverman when Nigel Farage
you went there, yeah.
had flown yeah. off to the jungle for I'm a Celebrity, because yeah. that man was on the warpath and marching and getting support amongst the Tories. And now that he's going to be eating kangaroo testicles, and other words, the drop in my voice there will tell you that I had other words in mind.
He was thinking about whether this is post-watershed, and it is. Yes, yeah. He's going to be eating kangaroo testicles, there's no doubt about it. Yeah.
Is Suella going to be on I'm a Celebrity, do you reckon?
Gosh, imagine if she was
parachuted in.
Yeah, imagine.
Literally parachuted in to the Australian jungle. But like, genuinely, you've hit on something, because it is actually, if you're ever going to do something that's going to upset the right of the Conservatives, like getting rid of the Home Secretary who wanted to deport every asylum seeker to Rwanda and leave them there and never have them settling in Britain at all, like, the time to do it is when the critic-in-chief is going to be busy gobbling on nether region in the nether regions of the planet.
David Cameron.
Out of town.
For his part, David Cameron has said that he has one job now, which is, I suppose, is the least of the commitments he can say.
You're a new manager.
I have one job. You had one job, David Cameron. So 7 years after leaving Downing Street, he's back in the saddle. We await with bated breath to see
how he gets it.
And if you'd like to watch Nigel Farage eating various unmentionables from unmentionables, you can watch I'm a Celebrity, which starts this Sunday on Virgin Media One.
Quick march of technology has been halted in the north of England, guys. Do you want to know why?
I welcome this.
Booths, which is not to be confused with Boots, the chemist.
Oh, so it's not the chemist?
No. Maybe we got this wrong in the group chat.
Anyway, I'm confused.
We're all out.
Go ahead.
So Booths, which is a small chain that sells groceries in the north of England since 1847, has announced this week...
Where are they from, Cornwalls?
My horse voice has led me to a strange accent place. They've announced this week that it would be getting rid of the self-checkouts in all but two of its 28 stores. So the chain is bucking a trend that has remade retail shopping around the world over the last 20 years. It says that having its employees interact with customers is going to provide a better experience.
I love this.
That's a great move.
There will no longer be an unexpected item in that bagging area, and I am here for it. I hate self-checkout. I always go to the till.
What's your problem with it?
There's always an unexpected item in the bagging area.
I think too much goes wrong.
Too much goes wrong. There's too many problems. You're standing there, you're waiting for somebody to come over and swipe the thing and press the button. The other day I was in the Tesco crossroad from my house, and there's only one person now working at the till.
Supervising everything else. Okay.
And like, I like to go to the little till and go, hi, how are you? And how's your day? And what time do you close at? And I like having the chats and doing the whole, and like, they're like, can you please just use self-checkout so that I can monitor all the self-checkouts? And I'm like, okay, sure.
You could be running interference for somebody else.
So then I'm still trying to chat to the guy while I'm doing the self-checkout. And the thing, I would say for like six items I bought, there was three different problems for six items. I'm like, I can't deal with self-checkout.
That sounds like the exception.
No, it's not the exception. It's my regular lived experience.
There's self-checkout in the Tesco that I do the big shop in. And that
you're self-checking out a big shop?
A lot of the time,
you're self-checking out a big shop.
And the unexpected
item. The amount of time you spend looking around for someone to come and help you.
Unexpected item, it's just not as much of a thing.
You would self-check out a big shop. I wouldn't. I would barely self-check out six items. Never mind a big shop.
I'd have lost my
no
senses.
Way, yeah, no way. No, no.
Two cartons of milk in, I would. No. Actually, I was recently, when I was away, I was in one of the airports I was in, had one of those Amazon self shop things.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay. Quite that's
where you just walk
scan your way in.
Yeah, and I went in because I actually didn't realize it was one of those. You don't have to like go up to a till or anything. You just walk out with it. You just carry out whatever you want to buy, and it'll get debited from your Amazon.
So you swipe yourself in. It knows how you're going to pay, and then you just take the stuff and leave.
Yes, but
how does it know what you took?
Because it's basically all just scanned, isn't it? Okay. When you're walking out with it. Okay. But anyway, this is my point of it. This is that when I was leaving, having not bought anything, some poor woman got mangled by the sliding doors, which shut so quickly on her as she was trying to get in.
Oh,
so yeah. So you can't leave these things to automation.
Some sort of RoboCop that wanted to pull down the shutters.
So I think it's because I was walking out and she was walking in through the inways. It must have just confused the system and just went brah, 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 and just shut over.
And a collision.
Made that sound.
The technical.
Clearly at her. Like.
Yeah. But like, I mean, these things, I just think, look, there's a place for the self-checkout thing because it can speed things through, but it shouldn't be the
doesn't
default
speed,
setting.
Though. It doesn't speed. I'm convinced it is much quicker to go to the human being. Every time
not if it's you and you're making conversation and you're asking what's going on in the world.
No, when I make conversation as they're like doing the process. But I just think that I'm delighted to hear this. Yeah. I would like to see more of this is what I'm saying. I've been long campaigning for the return of somebody on the forecourts and petrol stations. And I was just saying to you earlier that I love that.
What a lad to hold the pump.
Yeah.
But you used to do that old 90s thing where you'd have 20 quid and you'd hand it out the window and someone...
Although I did go to a petrol station recently that did have that and it was totally unexpected. And then I thought he was trying to rob me.
Do people have the cash anymore? Like, would they bring you out a contactless terminal or what did they do?
No, so this guy, I got out, I was at... this is a long story, but basically to summarise it very quickly...
We don't have time for a long story.
Sorry, no. Okay, anyway, I pulled into the petrol station, was about to get out to put diesel in. A man came to the window, obviously to fill my tank. I thought he was going to rob me. So then I was like, no thank you. And then when I went inside to the till, they were like, oh yeah, no, John fills the tanks all the time. And I was like, God, I've been crying out for Johns in my life to fill tanks.
And you just got him laid off because he's not doing
enough work. I didn't. I left him do it in the end, but yeah.
Maybe more adventures from Zara King and John on the Garage Forecourts in future episodes of the group chat. But that's all the time we have for this one. Zara, Gavin, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. We'll be back soon. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.